Imagine yourself walking down the street in a city somewhere when it starts pouring down rain and you have nothing to keep you dry. Lucky for you, this is a big enough city that there are sidewalk vendors selling umbrellas, but which do you choose? Do you want that sturdy golf umbrella that won't turn out inside out in the wind, or the little travel one that will collapse down into something you can fit in your pocket or bag later? And what color do you want? Or maybe that competing stall up the street has better umbrellas or better prices. You don't want to pick the wrong thing. But the longer you wait to make a choice, the wetter you get until there is really no point in having an umbrella at all. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The umbrella dilemma exists everywhere in the world today, where we have access to seemingly endless choices of careers, of causes, of partners. But when we scroll and scroll in search of the next option, we end up wasting a not infinite resource, our time. Pete Davis is here to argue for making a decision and going all in. He is co-founder of the Democracy Policy Network and author of the book Dedicated, The Case for Commitment in an Age of Infinite Browsing. Pete, welcome to Think.
So glad to be here.
So you start us out by invoking the philosopher Zygmunt Bauman's notion of liquid modernity. What does that term mean?
Well, liquid modernity is like the umbrella problem, but for everything in our lives. We never want to commit to any one identity or place or community, so we remain like liquid in a state that can adapt to fit any future shape. We focus in the now on being able to keep our options open for the future. And Bauman says it's not just us, it's, you know, the things out there are also liquid as well. You know, you can't rely on any job or role, idea or cause, group or institution to stick around in the same form for long, and they can't rely on us to do so either. So that's liquid modernity.
Well, the staying able to adapt to any necessary shape sounds good. So what do we lose when we do that?
Well, you know, I wrote the book and got turned on to this theme because, you know, that was the message we got. This is a good thing to remain like liquid, to keep your options open. You know, get the job that'll help you prepare for the next job. Don't get tied down to a person or a place you love because you never know what's going to be around the corner. You know, often it was like, don't speak too much about what you believe because that might hurt your future prospects. And so that was the message you got. This sounds like a good thing to have as many options as possible. But, you know, as I was growing up, I started noticing this other set of people that were not living by that message. They were the people that were committed to places, that were committed to communities, that were committed to causes, that were committed to crafts and institutions and ideas, people who closed doors and foregone options for the sake of something outside of themselves. And what you discover when you start looking at these people is they're the people that make the world go round. Everything that we hold precious today is because a long-haul hero from the past decided to close some doors to be committed to something. And everything we care about into the future, you know, all the causes we want to fight for, all the communities we want to revive, all the institutions we want to build or heal, they're going to require commitment as well. So if we all keep our options open, we're not going to have any of the things we love anymore.
All right, let's talk a little about those long-haul heroes. In explaining how we tend to misunderstand the benefits of commitment, you note that we tend to get hung up on the myth of these kind of dramatic movie moments, which you call dragon slaying, which imply that enormous changes happen all at once because of some big action taken by the hero. What do those movies fail to depict?
Yeah, you know, Hollywood wants to tell these stories because they are cinematic. You know, you need to create a scene if you're a Hollywood screenwriter. So, you know, they want to say, okay, the part of Martin Luther King's life that's worth looking at are the dragon slaying moments. To use one example, Martin Luther King. So you say, let's show him giving the Eye of a Dream speech. Let's show him facing down the fire hoses against Bull Connor's police force. But what you don't show, even though it's much more important, and because it's less cinematic, are the thousands of meetings that built up to those moments, are the thousands of Sundays where he honed his message that eventually became the riff in the Eye of a Dream speech are the thousands of, you know, course nights where he was doing phone trees to help organize people, or all the organizations that were already in those places that he was organizing, where countless, you know, nameless people that didn't make it into kind of the major history books, you know, had weekly meetings that kept that group together and ready to be activated for a cause. Take, you know, in the Montgomery bus boycott, a famous case, you know, we hear about Rosa Parks, sitting down and thus everybody stood up. What they don't tell you is Rosa Parks was the secretary of the local Montgomery NAACP for 10 years before that. The reason that her sitting down was so effective as a protest moment was because she had earned the trust of the community and she was a beloved elder in the community. And that role of building up that, becoming that beloved elder, weaving that community together, was the work of day in, day out, week in, week out, year in, year out, long haul work, not the work of gathering tinder, not necessarily just the spark where the tinder, you know, sets ablaze.
I think at the heart of our commitment phobia is this desire to know we can walk away from some commitment that doesn't reflect our authentic selves, right? We're afraid we will change our minds.
Yeah, you know, I talk about three fears when I've, in my research building up this book, you know, three fears are preventing us from committing. And two we know about. So one is fear of regret. You know, everyone understands this idea. I don't want to wake up 20 years later. I became a dentist and I should have become a plumber. Or I moved to Austin and I should have moved to Seattle or something. Then there's the fear of missing out. You know, I am fine with the decision I made, but it's coming with a lot of responsibilities that are preventing me from being everything, everywhere, with everyone. But there's this third one that we don't talk about as much, but I think it's a huge part of our commitment phobia, which I call the fear of association. It's the idea that I've taken all this time to discover my true self, and my true self is very static and isolated. I know what I want. I know who I am. I know what my reputation is. And I know, you know, I'm a Lego block. And if I'm searching for, you know, something to attach to, a cause, a community, a religion, a political movement, another person, a club to join, I'm trying to find the perfect exact Lego block that fits with my authentic self. And what you'll discover if you're thinking in that way, I'm static and isolated, is you'll discover nothing perfectly fits with you. Everything threatens your perfect, precise sense of your identity or your reputation or sense of control. Because, you know, nothing is exactly like you. If we want to become part of things bigger than ourselves, we have to be flexible and we have to start thinking about ourselves not as static and isolated, but as embedded and dynamic. You know, we change through our commitments. Our identities are not a fixed thing. They emerge through the things we commit to. Our reputation is not out there and then it's threatened by our commitments. It's actually, you know, we start disrespecting people who have no commitments and respect the people who become particular things. And sense of control, you know, anyone out there listening knows to join up with a community at the beginning, it's messy. Other people are annoying. Other people try to control you. Other people force you to do things you don't want to do. You might have joined for one reason, but then you have to go to the Thursday meeting or do the certain ceremony that doesn't exactly sit right with you. But over time, if you go through that valley of uncertainty and vulnerability that is community building, you reach a sense of security and comfort at the other end, which is being part of a community. No one wants to make friends or join a community, but everyone wants to have friends and be part of a community. And so one of the nudges of this book is, you know, it's time for us to be brave and go through that valley of community building to reach the other side.
Consumer culture has primed us to believe we want as many choices as possible. At what point does decision paralysis start to get in our way?
Yeah, there's this amazing book on this, The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz, where I took a lot of the parts of the book on this choice paralysis. And the idea is, you know, that Schwartz talks about a lot, and he's a psychologist, a professional psychologist. He looks at, you know, we want some choice. No one wants to be given no choices in life. But then at some point, those choices have diminishing returns. And there's actually two types of people he talks about: maximizers and satisficers. Maximizers are people who are trying to find the absolute maximally optimal choice. Satisficers are folks that are trying to find a choice that is satisfactory. It's fine. You know, it might not be the perfect one out there, but it'll do. And through many studies, he's shown, you know, the satisficers end up much more happier and serene than the maximizers, because the maximizers, even after choosing, because they went through that whole process of seeing all the alternative options, they're haunted by whether their choice was right or not. Whereas the satisficers have a whole different attitude where they're like, you know, this is fine and life is fine. And so he challenges us, if you're stuck in a maximizer mode, to switch to a satisficer one.
Is it that easy? Just decide to switch?
You know, it takes practice, but you know, he throw shows a bunch of ways that, you know, it's hard to switch from what you know in your head to, you know, what is in your heart and what becomes your habits. But he shows a lot of things you can think about and reflect on. So one is that, you know, when you're given so many options, you're haunted by all the unchosen options. So, you know, classic example, you're at, you know, one of these civic group dinners, and they say, you know, we have vanilla and chocolate ice cream. Choose vanilla or chocolate. You end up being much more satisfied with, you know, choosing between vanilla and chocolate versus going to Baskin Robbins and getting the 31 flavors, because, and, you know, trying a few, tasting this, tasting that, thinking about if you'd like this, thinking about you like that, because you're haunted by all the things you didn't pick. And it's also not just that you're haunted by the real options. You start mixing and matching the qualities of certain options and creating these like Frankenstein perfect options. So, you know, an example I gave is, you know, if you're considering where to live and you're choosing between, say, Austin, you know, Nashville, DC, and Paris or something on where to live, it's not just that if you choose DC, like Chicago, you're haunted by what other cities you could have been. You're also haunted by a magical city in your head that has, you know, Austin's wonderful Tex-Mex food and Paris's beautiful streets and DC's free museums and Miami's beaches, because you've seen the good in all the things you're not choosing. That's maximizer mindset, and it, you know, leads to a lot of unhappiness after you choose.
Okay, Pete, many people imagine young adulthood as kind of an ideal time for casting about and trying to find ourselves, experimenting with lots of different activities and career possibilities and even identities so that we can settle on one that fits. What is supposed to happen at the end of that time of exploration and experimentation that doesn't always happen these days?
Yeah, I'm so happy you bring that up, because I don't want this book to be processed. And if you read it, it's not in that tone. It's not a dogmatic, never quit, never browse book. It says, you know, browsing, the first chapter right after the introduction begins with, "I'd like to give browsing its due." And here's the part of browsing we love, you know, and especially this is what happens in most of our 20s. We love the flexibility that everything is quote unquote chill, you know, that, you know, when you go out on a date, it doesn't mean I'm committing to marriage, or when you go to a club meeting, it doesn't mean that that becomes who you are. And that allows you to, you know, explore. And one of the great parts of exploring is you get to find your authentic self. You get to actually shed inherited, involuntary commitments that don't fit who you are anymore. I talk about, you know, the summer after freshman year is often the time when everyone who came into college doing their high school clubs and signing up for the college equivalent of their high school clubs wake up from the haze of their inherited commitment and say, "Wait, I'm not actually really into swimming, or I'm not really into cello." That's what a great part of your early 20s is about. And there's deeper versions of that, like finding, you know, people coming out of the closet, people quitting a religion or taking on a new religion or discovering a cause that was the opposite of what they grew up in. You know, frankly, it's really fun. There's a lot of novelty that comes from browsing. But there's a moment where that all gets haunted. All of these pleasures of browsing become haunted by pains. And that's when usually it's time to start making a commitment. When you're jumping from thing to thing in a chill way, but suddenly that becomes this choice paralysis that we talked about. when your sense of finding your authentic self and always constantly thinking, who am I? What am I? Always being in the assessment mode of, is this thing truly me? Suddenly, you know, curdles into a sense of what Emile Durkheim, the historic sociologist, called anomie, a certain spiritual isolation, a sense of meaninglessness and drift. And eventually all that novelty starts feeling like shallowness. You know, I've seen it all. I've jumped from thing to thing. I've been to the rave. I've been to the show. I've done this. I've done that. And that's the time when, you know, my recommendation is, if you're starting to feel those pains more than those pleasures, start thinking of a different way of being, which is clicking out of infinite browsing mode, choosing a room off the hallway, and making a commitment to a particular thing outside of yourself, a place, a community, a person, a cause, a craft, an institution, an idea.
And I guess we have to get comfortable with the idea that once we make that commitment, that doesn't mean that all of our problems are solved. You write about what Ira Glass has said about the challenges of seeking depth, which is, you know, it can take a long time between the moment we commit to pursuing something wholeheartedly and the moment our skills match our ambitions. How do we get through that time without losing our enthusiasm?
Yeah, it's a long haul. Part of this is, you know, I talk about, in praise of all these long haul heroes, the reason they're heroic instead of just kind of ordinary folks is it's really hard to do a long haul. There's a lot of tedious meetings. There's a lot of trial and error, fits and starts, two steps forward, one steps back. But, you know, when I talk to them about what are the methods you use, I interviewed 50 long haul heroes for the book. And when I asked them, what are some of the methods that helped you stick with your long haul? Here are a few they told me. One was, a lot of them took a lot of time to really solidify their why and discover early on in their long haul, what is the why of what I'm doing, and almost make that like a totem that you return to. So when there's hard times, make sure to take some time out of your daily life of the hard long haul and sit and reflect on the why and take energy from that. Another that I loved was they tried to simplify their life to kind of get rid of the distractions or get rid of the emotional whiplash that can come over a long haul. So, you know, I talked to Evan Wolfson, and who was the person who marched for 32 years fighting for marriage equality. He started in the early 80s when most people thought him even proposing it in a law school paper was a wild thing to do, all the way towards it becoming, you know, a Supreme Court decision 32 years later. And he said, I had happy times on that walk. I had sad times, but I really worked hard to not be surprised or disappointed. I didn't make predictions about this is going to solve everything, or I know exactly how this is going to go, because this, when you do that, suddenly you find out, you know, oh, that path didn't work out, or that chapter was not as good as you thought it would be. And that surprise and disappointment can really drain you. And my favorite quote from the whole interview process about staying steady on the long haul is this wonderful public interest real estate developer named Monty Anderson. I think he's actually from Texas. And he said, I try to keep an even keel, you know, doing these, you know, community real estate projects. It's a really long process. He calls it going from the bottom of the ocean and trying to get to the moon. And he says, I try to have what, you know, I see as like an emotional HVAC system. When I'm down, I get grateful. When I'm up, I get humble. When it's going really well, I say, thus passes the glory of the world. This won't last long. And when it's going really poorly, I get thankful for the shoes on my feet and the clothes on my back and the food on my table and the ability to be able to do this long haul at all. And he says that allows him to not go back and forth between, you know, ego and despair and keep an even keel during it. So those are some tips along the way of sticking with your long haul.
So it sounds like these long haulers are not telling themselves, I can only be happy when my ultimate goal comes true. And they are also kind of finding ways to enjoy their progress along the way.
Yeah, they totally, all of them get a complete kick out of the fact that, you know, their life is part of, you know, I recently heard a phrase that someone on Twitter said every time something goes wrong, they say, oh, you know, it was good for the plot. And a lot of these long haulers really have that spirit of, you know, it's a real adventure to be on this long haul. It's, you know, they don't even, a lot of the ones that were really successful were ones who didn't even believe it could work out because it was too crazy of a thing to try. And thus they said, you know, everything's gravy on top of, you know, my expectation that this isn't going to work. And you know, I and they really used it as a way by staying consistent with something, they were able to notice the growth in their own life and get a kick out of that too. I talked to the rabbi in my town who's been rabbi for decades, Rabbi Amy Schwartzman, and she told me this joke story that she loves to tell, where rabbi and a cantor are sitting before the high holiday services, and the rabbi's studying the prayer book, and it's the 20th year of them together, you know, prepping for the high holiday service. And the cantor goes up to the rabbi and says, why are you studying the prayer book? You've been doing this for 20 years. It's the same prayers every year. Why do you need to study it anymore? And the rabbi responds to the cantor, the prayers haven't changed, but I have. And that's such a long haul hero spirited way of looking at something. Whereas when you commit to something, the thing sticks with you. You're in the long haul with it, but you change. And that makes every experience of the day in, day out, week in, week out, year in, year out feel new because you have changed. And you can, that makes, you know, even if it's a repetitive thing, feel fresh.
So, Pete, look, we all know people who seem to have understood from an early age exactly what they wanted to do with their lives. And we get that they, you know, worked hard along the way and sacrificed their time, but it does seem like maybe they never struggled to make that decision in the first place. What do you recommend to folks who agree it would be amazing to commit to something big, but don't feel like they've found any particular passion or have any particular talent to the that point to what that thing should be?
Yeah, you know, I give a taste of different types of commitments in the book. And I think it's important, you know, it's hard to think, what should I be committed to? And if we can start thinking more concretely about what are the different ways we can be committed, it might help a bit. So that's one step. So I'll talk about a few. One is commitment to causes. This is the work of citizens. Another is commitment to communities and places. I call this the work of patriots. Another is ideas and projects. That's the work of builders, maintaining previous institutions, other people's ideas and projects. That's stewards, crafts, commitment to crafts. That's artisans, and commitment, the most important commitment, I'll say, to other people. That's companions. So commitment doesn't have to be always, you know, like Evan Wolfson's commitment to the 32-year walk to do a major political change. It can be as small as committing to another person or joining a craft practice. But okay, so let's say you're grappling now with what, okay, I've thought I want to commit to a community, which community, or want to commit to a cause, which cause? Eventually, you know, there are two parts to it. One is we have to overcome these fears of regret and missing out and association. And I talk about, you know, what are some methods of overcoming those fears. A third part, though, even after you've overcome those fears, is you actually have to choose. And I think over time, we tell people in culture today that the only way to choose is your rational, analytical mind. And that's one way to choose, you know, make pro and con lists, really analyze everything, get more data. But I talk about in the book other ways of choosing. So one is to enlist your values. And a great way to enlist your values is to try to collect heroes over time. Because when you collect, it's hard to reflect on what are my values, what inspires me alone in a room. A great way to collect, to learn your values is to try to learn as many stories of long-haul heroes. You know, watch documentaries on people, read biographies of people, look up the history of your own town, look up the history of your workplace, look up the history of your profession, and try to find these moments and really get to know, you know, find older people that are mentors. And through collecting these heroes, you can start extracting what are the values that I care about and how can I be similar to them. Another one is what I the Jesuits, the Catholic order, call Ignatian discernment, which is instead of analyzing all of your options out there, you should reflect on how you feel when presented with the options. It's becoming much more in tuned and quiet, getting to a quiet place where you can become attuned to, do you feel good when presented with the possibility of an option? So really think about living in Vegas or living in Detroit, and then think about how you feel when that becomes a reality. Or really think about, what if I worked on the cause of intimate partner violence or climate change? How does that make me feel when I think about the reality of doing that? And you discern where your heart is leading you, where your values are leading you, and then through analysis, where your brain is leading you. My friend John has this wonderful method of, that's kind of a vulgar version of Ignatian discernment, which is, when people ask him for advice, he just to choosing between different options, he just says one of the options and says they should definitely do that. So they say, should I move to Atlanta or Philadelphia? He says, definitely Atlanta. No one wants to move to Philadelphia, but he picks at random. So no offense to Philadelphia. It could be the opposite way. And then they've, you know, if they react like, oh, I never want to do that, I definitely want to live in Philadelphia, then he says, well, then Philadelphia it is. And, or, you know, or if they say, that sounds wonderful, then he says, then Atlanta it is. And what he's doing is, by saying it so strongly, he's making it real to them, and then calling out their emotions to let them reveal to themselves what they feel about it.
Huh.
So that's another method of choosing.
You say that you'd like to see more apprenticeships in the world because they contain elements of duty and reverence. Current work culture really encourages people to move fast and break things. That's the Mark Zuckerberg ethos. What are the benefits of duty and reverence for people who find themselves at the beginning of their careers?
What's amazing is, you know, some people ask me, when you're talking about commitment, and this gets at answering this. When you're talking about commitment, are you talking about like committing to a health plan, or are you talking about committing to, you know, rise and grind every morning and, you know, build wealth, or, you know, achieve success? You know, some people misinterpret that. That's what I mean about committing. But I actually have a really specific type of commitment I mean. And I mean commitment to something outside of yourself that is bigger than yourself. That's why I say it's not really commitment to yourself. There are other self-help books out there to talk about that. I'm not against that. You know, you got to be there for yourself. But it's about commitment to joining up with a place, joining up with a community, joining up with a cause. And some people have asked when I've said that, well, why do you talk about crafts then? Aren't crafts about, you know, building your own private toolkit? Now you can play piano. Now you know how to do accounting. Now you know how to be an electrician. And what I discovered in my research about this is that there's actually this totally different way of thinking about a craft, which is, crafts are part of craft practices. There is a community of people that play piano. There is a history of all the, you know, there's a history to basketball. There's a future to basketball. That practice is sustained by countless people maintaining it, not just the, without the scorekeepers and the people managing the halls of fame and the people writing the coaching books and the referees. There's no LeBron James. Without the people managing the theaters where, you know, that are promoting opera, you know, continuing opera, there's no beautiful opera singers. Our crafts only have meaning in community as a practice. And so why I thought I wanted to talk about apprenticeships is, apprenticeships are not just about teaching you on YouTube the skill of, sawing a table, right? You know, my craft practices are clearly not the handy ones. You can probably tell listening, but like, you know, sawing wood in a particular way or learning how to play the flute. What masters and apprentices, what apprenticeships teach you is, they actually welcome you, the like deep ones, welcome you into the practice. They instill more meaning in it by giving you reverence and duty to it. You know, you're learning guitar because you got to love, you know, it's like those apprentices when they're teaching you guitar that are like, hey, you got to love your guitar. You know, here's all the differences. This is a Seagull versus this is a Martin. And here's the whole history. And this is what Paul McCartney played in 1964 at this stadium. And this is what this other person played. And this is what Dylan used when he went electric. And then suddenly when you're playing guitar, it's not just, I have learned this skill that now allows me to achieve an end of why I originally wanted to learn guitar. Now I can play Wonderwall. I've seen the YouTube video. It makes you feel like you're part of a deeply meaningful thing, and it makes the whole experience feel closer to the divine, if I can say that. And so that's why I think that's important, and that's the joy of commitment.
Okay, and before I let you go, how can folks who have made deep commitments to something important act as mentors to those who are still looking to do so?
That is very key. We need the number one way that I think people get connected to new commitments is because a long haul hero decides to take on mentees. We need to pass this down to the next generation. And I would encourage anyone that's on a side of a long haul to share their story with others and tell the story of their long haul. Don't just share the cinematic moments, share the parts of the tedious meetings or the times alone in the basement practicing. Share the hard times, because we need to start telling not just stories of grand moments of liberation, we also have to tell stories of dedication. And for those who aren't long haul heroes themselves, I would encourage you not to just start your own long haul hero journey, but to express gratitude for the long haul heroes that build everything we hold precious today. So reach out to that person who changed your life and tell them thank you for your long haul heroism.
Pete Davis is co-founder of the Democracy Policy Network and author of Dedicated, The Case for Commitment in an Age of Infinite Browsing. Pete, thanks very much for making time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Anna Perez, Nilufer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. You can listen to Think wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.